For the next 4 or so weeks, I want to talk about food, and that may seem like a strange topic and especially one to spend a month on. And so for that reason, I want to just give you an overview of what I do want to cover in the next month, because the Bible does have a lot to say about food and drink. And that's the first thing that I do want to cover today, is just show you just how much it does have to say about that topic. And then we want to go back to the very beginning. We want to look at how man was vegetarian before the flood in Noah's day. So up until that point, which was 1,656 years, nobody ate any meat, including the animals, for that matter. God only gave the animals vegetation to eat as well as men. And then after the flood, God gave men animals to eat without restriction. There was one little restriction, but there was no restriction on the type of animal or the particular animal that man could eat at that point. And then, quite a long time afterward, then the Lord gave the law of Moses to the children of Israel. And in that law, there was a dietary law, and it was very specific. And we're going to go through all that today. It doesn't really pertain to us today, but I think it's good to know these things and to learn about them anyway. And we're going to look at all the animals, land animals and sea animals and air animals and creeping things and insects and all types of different animals that were off limits to Israel. And then we're also going to look at the possible reasons for God giving that law. He doesn't really say what it is, so I'm just going to speculate a bit and look at maybe possible health reasons and possible spiritual reasons for it as well, for what it's worth. Then we're going to look at the fact, and that will take us up to the end of the sermon today, Lord willing, if I get that far. Then we're going to look at how there is no dietary law under the New Testament, and I'm going to give you the reasons for that. When I say no dietary law, there are a couple of restrictions, very few restrictions when it comes to what we can eat and drink, but nothing like it was in the law of Moses day. And then I want to talk about how our diet should not become our religion. And for some people, it is de jure their religion, which means by the law of their religion, their diet is their religion. And there are Seventh-day Adventists and people like that that have particular diets that they have to adhere to. But for other people, I've known people where it is de facto their religion, where it's not actually part of it, but they observe their diet with such religious fervor that it may as well be part of their religion, and to the point where it's like, I cannot eat certain things, and they would feel like convicted in their conscience about it if they eat certain things. So it may as well be part of their religion. And I want to talk about that, and how there is no Christian diet per se. Then we want to look at how eating food is a Christian liberty. We have a lot of leeway there when it comes to what we eat, and much leeway. We have pretty much as much leeway when it comes to what we eat as Noah did. Basically, just about the same restrictions that Noah was under are the same restrictions that we are under, which are not very many. And then we want to talk about how the Bible warns us about eating and drinking too much. And then I also want to talk about how the Bible warns us about eating too little. So we want to be in the middle, because you can eat too little and you certainly can eat too much. And if you've ever looked around at your fellow countrymen in this country, you know that there's a lot of people that eat too much and too much of the wrong stuff, which when I say wrong, I'm not rendering a moral judgment, but a dietary judgment. A lot of us eat way too much and way too much junk, and that's why we have the most obese culture, probably in the history of the world, I'm assuming. I don't think there's ever been a country that's been as obese as this country is today. And then I want to end talking about how food is integral to human relationships. And this is kind of where when I started this study, this is the thing that I was thinking about. And then it kind of morphed into this enormous study as I got looking at things and thought there's a lot of things that I could teach on here. And we want to talk about how Jesus used food and drink as the emblem to help us to remember his death and sufferings, if you think about that. And then lastly, then we'll finish up talking about how we will enjoy food in the new heaven, in the new earth, in our glorified bodies, that food is not just something for this life, but it will actually continue on into the next. So we have a lot to talk about here in the next month or so. So first of all, let's look at just the fact of how frequently food and drink is talked about in the Bible. I just want to give you some statistics here and some definitions. Food is defined, in case you didn't know what that is, if you're from another planet or something, food is what is taken into the system to maintain life and growth and to supply the waste of tissue, aliment, I think it's how you say it, aliment, nourishment, provisions, victuals. Now, it's not pronounced victuals. It is pronounced victuals, as a matter of fact, and you can look that up in a dictionary. I didn't know that. Well, I mean, it's been quite a few years ago now, but the first time I heard somebody say victuals, I just thought, when I realized what word they were pronouncing there, I thought, how do you get victuals out of V-I-C-T-U-A-L-S? But that is the case. Okay, so the word food is used 55 times in the Bible. The word meat or meats is used 298 times in the Bible. Now, meat, when we read meat a lot of times in the Bible, if you're not familiar with the King James, you would think of steak and pork chops, or probably not in the Bible because they didn't eat pork chops in the Bible, but flesh of animals is what we think of when we think of meat. But in the King James Bible, meat does not only refer to flesh. Meat refers to food in general. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly what the definition says. Food in general, anything used as nourishment for men or animals, usually solid food, in contradistinction to drink. So when Jesus says, "Have ye any meat?" he could have been referring to bread or fish or berries or any number of things. All of that is considered meat in the Bible. The word bread is used 361 times in the Bible. Now, bread, likewise, can also refer to just food. Usually it's more specific than that, though. In the Old English, it is bit or piece or morsel of food. And then secondarily, which the King James English is not Old English, it's Modern English. So secondarily, it is a well-known article of food prepared by moistening, kneading, and baking meal or flour, generally with the addition of yeast or leaven. So just like we would think of when we think of bread. If you notice in the Bible, if you've ever read 361 times, it makes use of the word bread. So bread was a common staple in the Bible, both Old and New Testament. A lot of people have an aversion to bread today. But the reason for that is, for one thing, there's a lot of food allergies, like Wayne has celiac, and so people like that can't eat it at all. But a lot of people also just get irritable bowels and they get problems. And I think that's from what I've read anyway, that's not because bread is bad necessarily. It's because the wheat plant has been modified, not even GMO modified, but modified through breeding over the last 50, 60 years, something like that. They modified it to make smaller, shorter wheat plants so that they wouldn't be affected by the weather and the wind as much, and made them to produce a lot more wheat on the same size plant. And when they did that, they apparently, I don't know if it increased the gluten amount in the wheat or it changed something in the wheat. And a lot of people have problems with wheat now that didn't have historically. And I've been told that if you go over to France, maybe Europe in general, but in France, I know a friend of mine that has allergies to wheat and couldn't eat wheat. And she went over there and just tried a little bit of bread and she was okay. She tried a little bit more and a little bit more, and she realized that she could eat all the bread she wanted over there and never had any problem. But over here, totally different. So something's going on there with the type of grain and the strand of grain or something that they use as opposed to what we use. But that's kind of a side note. That's not really, I didn't even intend to talk about that. The word drink and its cognates are used 409 times in the Bible. The word eat and its cognates are used 790 times in the Bible. So the Bible has a lot to say about eating and drinking, about food and drink and that general topic. And then just another curious thing, the first specifically stated law in the Bible was in regards to food. You ever think about that? Look at Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. Now, I was careful what I said. I said specifically, directly stated, because there was a law given before the law about not eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But the law is not specifically stated, it is inferred. And I'll show you what I'm talking about here in just a second. But here's the first specifically stated law that was written down. Genesis 2, 16 through 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. So the first commandment that God gives, where he explicitly states it there, had to do with eating. Don't eat of that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God said. Now, when I say explicitly stated, he put Adam in the garden there in verse 15. It says he put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. So if he put him in there to dress it and to keep it, he obviously told him to dress it and to keep it, and that was a law. If Adam would have just sat around and did nothing and didn't dress and keep the garden, then he would have been in violation of that law. He would have been a sinner for not doing that. So anyway, but the first one that's specifically stated there pertained to food. Now, prior to the flood, when God had first created Adam and Eve, and then in that 1656-year period up until the Lord flooded the earth, man was a vegetarian. If you look in Genesis 1 and verse 29, this is one of the, directly after the creation, once again, the first thing, it's just interesting if you think about it, the first thing that God talks about after he finishes the creation, second thing, I guess he told him to be fruitful and multiply first of all. After that, the next thing that he talks about is food. Genesis 1 and verse 29. It says, And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat. So God gave to men fruit-bearing seeds, herbs that bear fruit-bearing seeds and trees that bear fruit-bearing seeds. So like apples and pears and oranges and who knows, whatever else was around back then. So man was essentially a vegetarian. He could either eat of the herb of the field or the tree of the field, but he was not to be eating any living creatures, living as in animals. And it was the same law applied to the animals. They also were given herbs to eat there in verse 30. And to every beast of the earth and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat, and it was so. So in that day, all the carnivorous animals only ate vegetables. They only ate vegetables or grass or whatever. They did not eat each other. Lions didn't eat each other, and venomous snakes. Well, they were eating dirt, I guess. That's what the Lord said about the snakes. They were given dust for meat. But anyway, dinosaurs, they were all vegetarians. They were all herbivorous animals. That changed after the, well, at least for, I don't know about animals. For man, it didn't change until after the flood. Maybe animals after the fall, maybe they started eating each other. I don't know. It doesn't really say. In Genesis 2 and verse 16, we already saw that God reiterates there, every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat. So there were no restrictions when it came to the types of vegetation that Adam and Eve could eat. The trees of the garden, they could eat any of it except for that one, the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. They could not eat of that tree. And then after the fall, likewise, men are still restricted to eating only herbs. Genesis 3, 18 through 19 says, Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. This is part of the curse where Adam's now going to be working the ground with thorns and thistles instead of being in that nice garden. And thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. So that didn't change after the fall. Didn't change for a long time. Now, there was no permission given to eat animals after the flood. So when you read through the first 6, 7 chapters there of Genesis up until you get to the flood, you won't find, at least I didn't find, any permission given to eat animals. And you also don't find any record of man eating animals until after the flood as well. So God doesn't specifically tell them they can eat animals, and we don't see any example of anybody eating animals until after the flood. And therefore, we can conclude that man did not eat animals until after the flood, right? It doesn't specifically, you'd have to give me an example to show me where that happened to prove that they did not eat animals, because you can't prove a negative, right? I can't prove a negative. All I can show you is that there's no example of it, and to prove otherwise, you'd have to give me an example, and I have not found that. That will be significant here in a minute. So then after the flood, God gave animals to eat, gave man animals to eat without restriction, except for one little caveat. Genesis 9, 1 through 3. So this is after Noah gets off the ark. And it says, "And God blessed Noah and his sons, and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." Just like he had told Adam and Eve over a millennia and a half earlier than that. "And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea, into your hand are they delivered." So that tells me that apparently there was not fear of man in the animals prior to that point. When the animals came up to the ark, they just walked right up and walked in, and they weren't afraid of Noah, and Noah was probably not afraid of them because they weren't eating each other at that point. But now the fear of men and the dread of men are on the animals. That's why hunting is difficult. You just can't go out there and just grab one and slice its neck or something. You got to sneak up, and you got to be quiet, and you got to not move, because if they see you, they're going to run. They're afraid of us now. "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you." Or remember, food for you, as we've learned. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. "Even as the green herb have I given you all things." God makes reference back to when he gave him the green herb. This is why I say God now tells them that every moving thing is meat for them, just like the herb used to be. So clearly they weren't eating living things up until this point. "But the flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat." So there's the caveat. The one caveat was that they could not eat blood, but they could eat any living, any moving thing. It didn't matter what it was. Pigs, shrimp, shellfish, mussels, oysters, you name it. All the stuff that God later prohibited them from eating in the law of Moses, Noah could eat any of it. "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you." Now, there are people out there that try to say that Noah was under this dietary law. They think we've always been under this dietary law of the law of Moses. And yet it says, "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you." Now, how much plainer could God have gotten if he was trying to say, you can eat whatever you want? There is no dietary law. I don't know how you could have stated it more plainly than that. "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you." So there was nothing that was kept from them at that point. Now, prior to the flood, there were clean and unclean animals. Genesis 7 and verse 2. Some people from this conclude that, see, there was a dietary law. This is bunk, and I'll explain to you why in just a second. There was no dietary law. Well, except for the fact that they were only supposed to eat herbs. I mean, that was the law, but there was no dietary law with respect to what type of animals they could eat prior to the flood, because they couldn't eat any of them. Genesis 7 and verse 2. "Of every clean beast..." This is Noah, God giving Noah instruction here right before they go on to the ark. "Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female." So clearly, even when they weren't eating animals, there were still clean and unclean animals. Now, in that man was not permitted to eat any animal prior to the flood, this classification of clean and unclean was not given in regards to diet. Right? It wouldn't make any sense. These people say, see, there were clean and unclean animals. They were only allowed to eat the clean animals. They weren't allowed to eat any of them. Right? If you're going to say clean and unclean is in reference to what they could eat, they'd all been unclean because they weren't allowed to eat any animals prior to the flood. Remember what he said there in chapter 9? He's given them now every living creature, as they had the herbs of the field prior to that. The clean and the unclean distinction was given to men to know which animals they could sacrifice to God. That's what the clean and the unclean was about. It wasn't about what they could eat. Look at Genesis 8 and verse 20. Genesis 8 and verse 20. Because you might wonder, why were there seven of certain animals taken on the ark, seven pairs, and only one pair of certain other animals? I think a lot of people forget about that seven pairs thing. You see the children's nursery book pictures, and it's always two animals going onto the ark. But with many of those animals, it would have been 14 animals going onto the ark, seven pairs of the clean ones. And the reason for that was that God wanted to sacrifice after they got off the ark. And the problem is, if they would have sacrificed sheep and oxen and goats, guess what? We wouldn't have any sheep and oxen and goats anymore, right? If they had only taken one pair and then sacrificed even one of them, well, that would have been the end of the clean animals, wouldn't it? That's why they had to take seven of them. Genesis 8 and verse 20 says, "And Noah built an altar," this is after he gets off the ark, "and Noah built an altar unto the Lord and took of every clean beast," remember those are the ones that he had seven of, "and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar." This is why they had the classification of clean and unclean, because there were certain animals that God wanted used for sacrifice and certain animals he didn't want used for sacrifice. And you remember back in Genesis chapter 4 with Cain and Abel, God had dictated certain terms of his religion even way back in the very beginning with Abel and with Cain, and Abel did it the way that God said. We're told in the New Testament that by faith Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. So Abel was making his offering by faith, which means he was doing it by the word of God, because we read in Romans chapter 10 that faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Right. So Abel was a prophet. God had told him how he wanted to be worshipped, and Abel did it the way that God told him to do it. Cain didn't. It says in Genesis 4 and verse 3, "In process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord, and Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering." You see, God had certain ways that he wanted to be worshipped, and it wasn't through a fruit basket like Cain wanted to offer. It wasn't the fruit of the ground. It was the firstlings of the flock. And based on what we're told there in later in Genesis with the clean and unclean animals, the firstlings of the flock would have been some of those clean animals. God only wanted sacrifice by certain types of animals. And the flock would be like sheep and cows and things like that, clean beasts. And God would later go on to tell us specifically which ones are clean and unclean. So like I said, this is the reason for the seven pairs of the clean animals. Now, as we saw there in Genesis 9:4, I already alluded to this, there was that one dietary law, and that was no eating blood. And that law continues until this day. That is the one law that has not changed. It was prohibited by Noah to Noah and his family. It was prohibited in the law of Moses, and it is still prohibited under the New Testament today. If you look in Acts 15 and verse 20, whenever the Gentiles were being brought into the church, and at that time the churches were Jewish churches. This is just shortly after the conversion of Cornelius, so there were very few Gentiles. But when they start to come in, then the Pharisees come and they want to convert all these Gentiles to be Jews. They want to make them be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. And the church in Jerusalem at that time had a council where the apostles and elders got together, and they wanted to decide what these Gentiles needed to keep. What parts of the law of Moses did they need to keep? And the ruling was that they only needed to keep these four items here that were given by James in Acts 15 and verse 20. He says, "But that we write unto them," that is to these Gentiles that are converted, "unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from things strangled and from blood." So they couldn't eat animals that were sacrificed to idols. The type of animal didn't make any difference. It was whether the animal was sacrificed to an idol. They couldn't eat that. They couldn't eat animals that were strangled and didn't have the blood drained out of them. But that doesn't specify what type of animal. And they couldn't eat blood itself. And that goes whole way back to the law that God gave to Noah. And there you have it, right there is the New Testament dietary law in a verse. Now we'll get to that. We'll talk more about that later on in this study. So then after Noah, you got quite a bit of time that transpires, and God calls his people out of Egypt, and then by Moses, he gives them this law on Mount Sinai. And in this law that God gave Moses was a dietary law. And we're going to spend the remainder of the time talking about this law. And in this law, there were many animals that were off limits to Israel. Other than the fact that God didn't give them animals to start with, prior to this point, there was no dietary law when it was in respect to what animal you can eat and what animal you can't. But then the Lord really tightened things up, and he got very specific. And I'll give you some thoughts as to why that might have been here at the end of the sermon. So let's first of all talk about land animals, because we can break it into land animals, into birds, into sea creatures, and then even insects and bugs and things like that, and rodents and varmints and those. So we'll first look at the land animals, the larger animals. And God had given this interesting commandment, and why he came up with this, I can only speculate. But the commandment was that only animals that had parted hoofs, like that, and chewed the cud, I'm not going to give you an example of that, that would be disgusting, but and chewed the cud would be permissible for them to eat. Chewing the cud, you know what chewing the cud is? That certain animals like cows and deer and other animals, they have, I think they maybe have four stomachs or two, four stomachs, and they eat the food and it goes into the one stomach, and then it comes, and then whenever they have a chance to go and sit down, then they basically barf it up into their mouth and they chew it again, and then they swallow it, and that's what they do. I watched this video of a deer chewing the cud. It was the coolest thing because he's sitting there and he's just munching away. And he swallows, and then all of a sudden, and you can actually see it come right up his chest, boop, and you can see like the little bump come up, and then he starts chewing again, and he swallows, and then and it comes back up again, and yeah, it's pretty neat. I don't know, they must not have taste buds like we do because that's just gross. But anyway, that's what they do. And for whatever reason, that is considered clean to God, puking it up and eating it again, but that's what he considered a clean animal that you could eat. And had to have a parted hoof, so it couldn't have a unparted hoof, like couldn't be a dog or something like that. So anyway, let's look at that. Leviticus 11 and verse 3. Leviticus 11, 3. This law was given in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. We'll look at both of these. Leviticus 11 and verse 3. The Lord says, "Whatsoever parteth the hoof, and is cloven-footed, and cheweth the cud among the beasts, that shall ye eat." Okay, so parteth the hoof and is cloven-footed, which is basically the kind of the same thing, I think. Parting the hoof, so it's split. So there's a divider in the hoof or the foot into two parts. And then in Deuteronomy 14 and verse 6. The Lord reiterates the commandment. Deuteronomy, the word Deuteronomy means, I think it means giving again or something. So it is a, if you read through Deuteronomy, he's recovering the information that was covered in the earlier books of Moses. Deuteronomy 14 and verse 6, which basically says about the same thing. He says, "And every beast that parteth the hoof and cleaveth the cleft into two claws and cheweth the cud among the beast, that ye shall eat." So this would include then the following animals. First of all, we'd have cows and oxen, sheep, goats. That would be the first group there in Deuteronomy 14 and verse 4. He says, "These are the beasts which ye shall eat, the ox, the sheep, and the goat." This would also include deer and then some other animals here. In verse 5, the hart, which is a deer, I'll give you the definition of that. The hart and the roebuck and the fallow deer and the wild goat and the pygarg and the wild ox and the camois, or maybe camois. I don't know if that's a French word or not, but anyway, it's something anyway. Let me define some of those words for you. So these are all clean animals. These would all have parted hoofs and chew the cud. So a hart is a deer. It is the male of the deer, especially of the red deer, a stag, specifically a male deer in its fifth year. And then you have the roebuck there. The roebuck is the buck or male of the roe deer, a male roe. I'm just defining some of these words. These animals are strange sounding and we're not familiar with them, so that's one of the reasons why I'm going through this, and I'm going to define the ones that we don't know what are. I'm not going to define an ox. I think everybody knows what that is. Then also you have the wild goat, you have the pygarg. Pygarg, if that's how you pronounce that, is a kind of antelope mentioned by Herodotus and Pliny. These are ancient writers. By some supposed to be the Attics, Addax. I don't know what that is, but I'm assuming it's a pygarg, and that's an antelope. So there you go. And then you have the wild ox, which I'm assuming is a rogue ox or something. He's gone off the plantation apparently or something. And then you have the camois or camois. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. And that is a capriform antelope, so another type of antelope. I'm not even going to pronounce those words. The only representative of the antelopes found wild in Europe. It inhabits the loftiest parts of the Alps, Pyrenees, Tarsus or Taurus, and other mountain ranges of Europe and Asia. So they're antelopes that live up in the mountains. And then also, these are not listed, but these animals do part the hoof and they do chew the cud. So we have at least three other ones, and that is the buffalo, the giraffe, and the gazelle. So those would have all been clean animals as well. But I'm not aware of, and I could be wrong, but I'm not aware of buffaloes anywhere besides in North America. But maybe they have them other places. But if they don't have them in Israel, that would make sense why God didn't list them, because chances are, the Jews wouldn't have come across those animals. So then this law, the parted hoof and the chewing the cud, this would exclude some animals. It would exclude animals that chew the cud but don't have a split hoof. And some examples of that would be the camel, the hare, and the coney, Deuteronomy 14 and verse 7. Nevertheless, these ye shall not eat of them that chew the cud, or of them that divide the cloven hoof, as the camel and the hare and the coney, for they chew the cud but divide not the hoof, therefore they are unclean unto you. So they did chew the cud, right? But they did not divide the hoof. So it had to be both, remember. So a camel does not have a cloven hoof, neither does a hare. A hare is like a big rabbit, basically. And then a coney. A coney is a rabbit, formerly and properly of ordinary name, but now superseded in general use by rabbit, which was originally a name for the young only. So a coney is basically just a rabbit. Now I think coneys taste pretty good, the rabbit part, but the ones that really taste good are the coneys that come from Skyline Chili in Cincinnati. Those coneys are good. They're the little hot dogs with the Skyline Chili on it and the big mound of shredded cheese. If you've never been to Skyline, you really need to try that place. It's some of the finest dining in the world that I've ever found. It's incredible. It's a fast food joint, but it is great. Either you're going to love it or hate it. I can tell you that much. There's some people that love it and some people that hate it, and you usually don't find people in the middle there. But anyway. And then you also have animals excluded that have the split hoof, but they don't chew the cud. An example of that is swine. Verse 8. And the swine, because it divideth the hoof, yet cheweth not the cud, it is unclean unto you. Ye shall not eat of their flesh, nor touch their dead carcass. So the Jews were not to eat pigs, which makes me wonder there in Israel, whenever Jesus cast that legion of devils out of the man into that herd of swine, and they ran violently down over the cliff and were drowned in the sea. Why there were people in Israel keeping swine, I don't know. Apparently they weren't Jews, or else they were not obedient Jews, one of the two. So that takes care of the land animals. Then let's go to the sea creatures. So with the sea creatures, there was the law was that they had to have fins and scales, both. And as long as they had fins and scales, they're permissible to eat. Let's look first of all at Deuteronomy 14, 9 through 10, and then we'll go back to Leviticus. Deuteronomy 14, 9 through 10 says, "These ye shall eat of all that are in the waters, all that have fins and scales shall ye eat. And whatsoever hath not fins and scales ye may not eat, it is unclean unto you." And then let's go back to Leviticus. Pretty much says the same thing. In Leviticus 11 and verse 9, says, "These shall ye eat of all that are in the waters, whatsoever hath fins and scales in the waters, in the seas, and in the rivers, them shall ye eat." So fins and scales. So this would include most fish, including bass, carp, flounder, grouper, haddock, halibut, herring, mackerel, mahi-mahi, orange roughy, perch, pike, pollock, salmon, sardines, snapper, sole, tilapia, trout, tuna, walleye, whitefish, and whiting, just to name a few, and I'm sure there's plenty more. It would exclude one particular type of fish, a couple types of fish. One is the catfish, because catfish do not have scales. Has fins, but no scales. So catfish were a no-no for the Jews. And it would also exclude shellfish, clams, shrimp, lobster, mussels, eels, sharks, sturgeons, squid, scallops, and swordfish, because they don't have scales and fins. Or like a shark has fins but no scales, right? So it has to have both. Now we'll get into some possible reasons why this law existed here in just a little bit. And then let's look at the birds. So for Israel, all clean birds were permissible for them to eat. Now in this list, let's look at Deuteronomy 14. Let's look at just verses 11 and 20. God doesn't actually specify what the clean birds are that they could eat. He specifies a bunch of unclean ones, but he doesn't actually say which ones they can eat. Now, Deuteronomy 14, 11 and 20 says, "Of all clean birds ye shall eat." And then verse 20, "But of all clean fowls ye may eat." So there's a good definition of fowls, birds, right? They're the same thing. So what I've done is I've done a little bit of reasoning from the scripture to try to determine some examples of some clean birds. And I've come up with, about four of them here, at least, that I can find that would be clean animal or clean birds. And I'll give you my reasoning here as I go through this. So first of all, the quail. Look at Psalm 105 and verse 40. Because when you look through the rest of Deuteronomy 14 and in Leviticus 11 there, it does not list off any clean bird that I am aware of. It just tells you a bunch of the ones that they can't eat. So Psalm 105 and verse 40. This was giving a little bit of history of Israel in the wilderness here. And when they were hungry, God gave them manna to eat, and then they started clamoring for flesh, and God gave them quail to eat as well. Psalm 105 and verse 40 says, "The people asked, and he brought quails and satisfied them with the bread of heaven." Now, obviously, God is not going to give them an unclean bird to eat, right? He would not make provision for their hunger with something that they were forbidden to eat, right? That would be tempting them to sin. So clearly, quails are clean birds, just from that little bit of reasoning there. Then we also have the turtle dove and the pigeon. These are also clean birds, and I'll show you why. Look at Leviticus 12 and verse 6. Leviticus 12 and verse 6. This is the law given for a woman whenever she bore children, that she was supposed to offer certain sacrifices based on, I think it was even based on maybe the timing was based on whether it was a male or a female child, and then whether she was rich or poor, she was supposed to give certain sacrifices. And in verse 6, Leviticus 12 and verse 6, "And when the days of her purifying are fulfilled for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring a lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation unto the priest." So she's supposed to bring a sacrifice, and that sacrifice could include a pigeon or a turtle dove. Okay. Now, remember what God said to Noah, that he was supposed to make a sacrifice of clean beasts. Remember that in Genesis 8 and verse 20. We don't need to go back there. We've already seen that. So when God wants a sacrifice, it is only of a clean beast. He does not want unclean animals sacrificed to him, right? And he says this in Leviticus 27 and verse 11, that it's only clean beasts that are sacrificed. Leviticus 27 and verse 11 says, "And if it be any unclean beast, of which they do not offer a sacrifice unto the Lord, then he shall present the beast before the priest." So unclean beasts don't get sacrificed. So therefore, these birds were clean birds, right? Because God was accepting them as a sacrifice. And the Lord had said there in Deuteronomy 14 that of every clean bird you can eat, right? So therefore, they could eat doves, turtle doves, and pigeons. Those were considered clean birds. And then the only other clean bird that I can find in Scripture, and specifically stated anyway, is the cock, which is a chicken. You remember in Mark 14:72, I don't think we need to turn there, but when the Lord had told Peter that before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. So he was referring to the cock crowing, which obviously is a chicken because those are the ones that crow, roosters specifically. And then let's look at Luke 11 and verse 12. Because I want to reason here with you to show you that a chicken would be a clean bird. Luke 11 and verse 12. Jesus here is giving instruction on prayer. And he says, "Or if he shall ask an egg," talking about your son, "if he shall ask an egg, will he offer him a scorpion?" Okay, so if your child asked for you an egg, you wouldn't give him a scorpion. The point is, if he asked for an egg, you'd give him an egg. Well, that tells me that eating eggs was permissible in the Bible, right? Because he wants one to eat, and Jesus is using that as an example. Now, let me just define a cock for you. Cock is the domestic fowl. The male of the common domestic fowl, Gallus domesticus, the female being the hen. So it doesn't actually specifically say chicken, but if you think about it, chickens are definitely the most common domesticated fowl anyway. I mean, they have domesticated turkeys and other birds as well, but chickens are definitely the most common one. And the fact that Jesus said before the cock crow, he's obviously talking about roosters, because I'm not aware of any other birds that crow. Roosters are certainly commonly known for that. Now, eggs are permissible to eat. We just saw that there in Luke chapter 11. Was it Luke 11? Luke 11. And chickens are most well known among birds for laying eggs that people eat, right? I think that's pretty well established. So if chicken eggs were allowed to be eaten, then chickens from which the eggs came were clean birds, and they were also allowed to be eaten. That was probably a whole lot of reasoning that was unnecessary. You probably just figured chickens are clean birds because everybody eats chickens. They've always done that for a long time. But anyway, I think that's some pretty solid reasoning from Scripture to show you that chickens are clean birds. Now, you could also argue it this way. You could argue that since there are no examples of clean birds given in Leviticus 11 or Deuteronomy 14, right, because he gives a bunch of unclean ones, and we'll get to those in just a second. But he doesn't specify any birds that are clean, and yet we're given 21 examples in those chapters of unclean birds. You could reason to say that any bird that's not in the list of unclean birds is a clean bird. Right? That would be pretty, I think that would be a logical argument to make, because otherwise you look and God doesn't actually tell you what a clean bird is. So that would be pretty good reason to assume that anything that's not mentioned as unclean must be clean. So let's look at some of these birds. I'll just read you the passage, and then we'll just walk through and I'll define some of these odd-sounding birds that you've never heard of before, except whenever you read through Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Leviticus 11, 13 through 19. And a lot of these are common. I think there's some of them that are only found in one list or the other, so I'm going to read you both lists. Leviticus 11, 13 through 19. I realize that none of this applies to us today, but I think nevertheless it's interesting just to learn about God's law back in the Old Testament. And so it's just more of an educational instruction than it is to make you a better Christian or something, because this is probably not going to change, you know, your religion very much. Leviticus 11, 13 through 19. "And these are they which ye shall have in abomination among the fowls." So God really, he does not want you eating this stuff. You should hate and be disgusted by the thought of eating these particular birds. That's what abomination means. "They shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. The eagle and the ossifrage and the osprey and the vulture and the kite after his kind. Every raven after his kind. And the owl and the night hawk and the cuckoo and the hawk after his kind. And the little owl and the cormorant and the great owl and the swan and the pelican and the gyre eagle and the stork and the heron after her kind, and the lapwing, and the bat." And then we go to Deuteronomy 14, and we may pick up a couple of more here. Deuteronomy 14, 12 through 18. In verse 11, he says, "Of all clean beasts ye shall eat, but these are they, of which ye shall not eat, the eagle, and the ossifrage, and the osprey, and the gleed, and the kite, and the vulture after his kind, and every raven after his kind, and the owl, and the night hawk, and the cuckoo, and the hawk after his kind, the little owl, and the great owl, and the swan, and the pelican, and the gyre eagle, and the cormorant, and the stork, and the heron after her kind, and the lapwing, and the bat." So there are the birds that are unclean, and let's just go through a few of these and define the terms. So everybody knows what an eagle is. Interesting that the bird that symbolized the Roman Empire was an abomination to God, and the bird that symbolizes the United States is an abomination to God. I think that's kind of interesting. But then we have the ossifrage. The ossifrage, not to be mistaken with the ostrich, but the ossifrage is a rendering of the Latin ossifregia, or as a name for the lammergeier or gyre eagle, or of some kindred species identified with the bird called by the Romans ossifregia. So that probably didn't help matters much, did it? It says that it is another name for the lammergeier. The lammergeier is the bearded vulture, some other Latin word that I can't pronounce. It is the largest European bird of prey, and inhabits lofty mountains in southern Europe, Asia, and northern Africa. So the lammergeier is a vulture. So the ossifrage is a vulture. Now, if any of you have ever seen vultures, and I'm sure you have, you see why God wouldn't want you eating those things, because they are nasty, ugly, stinky, disgusting. I mean, if it was between that and starving to death, I suppose I would eat one, because we are allowed to eat one today. But remember, all things are lawful, but all things are not expedient. I would not recommend shooting vultures, buzzards as we call them. I don't know if you call them buzzards here. We call them buzzards where I'm from. Yeah, disgusting. But you know what? I'm really glad that the Lord made those disgusting creatures, because they clean up all the dead stuff. They eat, I mean, you wonder why they, I'm sure, imagine how a vulture tastes considering what his diet is. He eats maggots and rotten meat and disgusting stuff. Oh, and they are hideous looking too. You ever scope them things out, and you get a good look at them, and that nasty head, and ugh. Osprey, I think we know what that is. That's a bird of prey. They have those down in Florida. Vulture, same as the ossifrage. A gleed. Gleed is the kite. It is now chiefly north and something. I don't even know what that means. It says here in the little note in the dictionary, the name is also locally applied to other birds of prey as the buzzard. Okay, so it's not just me. As the buzzard, osprey, and peregrine falcon. The kite is sometimes distinguished as the fork-tailed, red, or salmon-tailed gleed, while the names of blue, brown, and white aboon gleed are given to the hen harrier. I'm sure that has improved the quality of your life, knowing all that information. So that's what the gleed is. Then the kite is a bird of prey of the family Falconidae, Falconidae or something like that, and subfamily Milvinae. Having long wings, tail usually forked, and no tooth in the bill. That's what a kite is. Then we know what ravens are. They look about like a crow, black, small black bird. Owl, nighthawk, cuckow. A cuckow, I got this from Wiktionary. It wasn't in the OED, but a cuckow is the obsolete form of cuckoo. And cuckoo is in the OED. A cuckoo is a bird, calculus canarus, well known by the call of the male during mating time, of which the name is an imitation. So I am assuming that the cuckoo says cuckoo whenever he's looking for a wife. Cuckoo, 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 right? Repeated. Then you have the hawk. We all know what those are. Little owl. That's just an owl that hasn't matured yet to the same stature as the great owl. A cormorant is a large or voracious seabird. It is about 3 feet in length and of a lustrous black color, widely diffused over the northern hemisphere and both sides of the Atlantic. Also, the name of the genus, including about 25 species, some of which are found in all maritime parts of the world. So a great big 3 foot long blackbird, essentially. You'll notice that almost all of these unclean birds are birds of prey. That has something to do with why the Lord considered them unclean. Then you have the great owl, the swan, we all know what those are, pelican, just saw some of those in Florida this week, the gyre eagle is a vulture, stork, heron, I think we all know what those are, lapwing, a lapwing is a well-known bird of the plover family, I'll skip the Latin there, common in the temperate parts of the Old World, called also pewit from its peculiar cry. Its eggs were the plover's eggs of the London markets. Allusions are frequent to its crested head, to its wily method of drawing away a visitor from its nest. Kind of sounds like the killdeer to me. You ever see killdeer? And they, whenever you get near, they nest on the ground, and whenever you get near their eggs, then they start squawking and running and lying on their side with their wing out like it's broken and trying to get you to chase after them to get away from the nest. The Lord has quite the sense of humor, I think, whenever I see animals like that. And to the notion that the newly hatched lapwing runs about with its head in the shell. Now, that must be a funny sight to behold, that little bird running around with a shell on his head. And then the bat. And anybody that's ever seen a bat probably would have no contention with the Lord about outlawing those disgusting-looking creatures. Once again, I'm glad they're around. They eat up a bunch of bugs and... But yeah, I wouldn't want to eat one. Those are some of the most hideous looking creatures I've ever seen in my life. Now, most flying, creeping things, as the Bible calls them, which would be bugs and insects, were forbidden. But there were a few that were not forbidden. If you look in Leviticus 11, 20 and 23, most of them are forbidden. Leviticus 11 and verse 20. It says, all fowls that creep, going upon all four, shall be an abomination unto you. And then verse 23, but all other flying, creeping things, which have 4 feet, shall be an abomination unto you. So he just gives just a few of them here that are okay to eat. But anything else, any other insects, in other words, were to be had in abomination. Now he defines these insects that were okay to eat as having legs above their feet. And if you think about it, we all kind of have legs above our feet. But if you think about that, think about a grasshopper, and his feet are below his legs. Like his legs are right directly above his, when he's crouched down, they're right above his feet. So that's basically what the Lord's talking about there. Verses 21 and 22, these were allowed to be eaten. Yet these may ye eat of every flying, creeping thing that goeth upon all four, which have legs above their feet. Because you think about it, some bugs, their feet are spread out, so their legs are not above their feet, like a lot of the bugs, you know, but the grasshopper, the legs are directly underneath their feet. Verse 22, even these of them ye may eat, the locust after his kind, and the bald locust after his kind, and the beetle after his kind, and the grasshopper after his kind. So they were allowed to eat these four items. Locusts, we know what locusts are. Bald locusts, those are either old locusts or they have a family gene that caused them to lose their hair early. And then the beetle and the grasshopper. Okay, so they were allowed to eat those. And I don't know why you'd want to eat any of those, and I don't even know why the Lord would consider them clean, to be honest with you. They wouldn't. I mean, if you just said to me, hey, let's look at all these animals and you figure out which ones are clean, that wouldn't have been something that I would have naturally decided on my own. I wouldn't want to eat any of those things. That just does not look appealing to me. But remember, the Lord's ways are not our ways, neither his thoughts our thoughts. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts, so maybe we should eat locusts. I don't know. He gave them to Israel to eat. Grasshoppers, maybe they're good for you. I don't know. He probably had some reason for doing it. And then you have creeping things, as the Bible calls them, that are forbidden. And there's a few of these. Leviticus 11, 29 through 30. It says, these also shall be unclean unto you among the creeping things that creep upon the earth, the weasel and the mouse and the tortoise after his kind. No turtle soup for the Jews. And the ferret, and the chameleon, and the lizard, and the snail, no escargot for you Frenchmen, and the mole. These are unclean to you among all that creep. Whatsoever doth not, or whosoever doth touch them, when they be dead, they shall be unclean until the even. So they were not allowed to eat any of those items just listed there. Some of them are certainly understandable. Who would want to eat a mouse? I know that they eat stuff like that over in Asia. They eat rats and all kinds of gross stuff over there. But yeah, the turtle, I don't know. I don't know why the Lord, maybe turtles have, there's some reason why they're not healthy to eat or not good or could have been dangerous to eat or something. I don't know. So then let's get into the health reasons that God might have had for forbidding some of these animals that were listed. And granted, this is speculation because God doesn't say. But it seems to be, you know, could, I don't think it's unreasonable to think that maybe these were some of the reasons that the Lord had. For one thing, you have parasites in swine that can be very harmful to humans if it's not fully cooked. That's why when you do eat pig, you always want to make sure it's cooked. You don't ever, you know, you don't eat pig medium rare or something like that unless you want to get very sick. There's a disease called trichinosis. This is from an article on trichinosis in at medicinenet.com. I'll read this to you here. Let me get my glasses on. Trichinosis is caused by eating raw or undercooked pork and wild game infected with the larvae of the parasitic worm. The contaminated meat is infected with the larvae of a worm called Trichinella. Yeah, Trichinella spiralis. The initial symptoms of trichinosis are abdominal discomfort, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, fatigue, fever. The severity of symptoms depends on the number of infectious worms consumed in the meat. So, given that the Jews certainly wouldn't have known anything about microscopic worms or anything like that in those days, it could have certainly, that could have been a reason why the Lord prohibited it. And they maybe didn't have the best methods of cooking. And if you eat beef and you don't get it quite cooked the whole way through, no problem. You eat pork and don't get it cooked the whole way through, you could get very sick. So that could have been one of the reasons. And then you have a lot of these delicious sea creatures that don't have fins and scales. And some claim that these are full of toxins and they carry foodborne illnesses. And I'm going to read here. This is from a website, The Gathering of Christ Church. No fins, no fin, or no scales, no fins, no good. These guys, of course, have an axe to grind because they're some of the ones that don't, they put themselves under the law of Moses and think that these, you know, it's unlawful to eat these animals. So take it with a grain of salt what they say, because of course, you know, they're trying to justify themselves. But anyway, I'll let you decide if you think that this is right or not. He says, now we know that fish with scales and fins are equipped with a digestive system that prevents the absorption of poisons and toxins into their flesh from the waters they call home. Flounder, cod, haddock, and salmon are a few examples of fish with scales and fins. Catfish have fins, but do not have scales. These scavengers are primarily bottom feeders and have digestive systems designed to absorb toxins from the water. Clams, lobster, shrimp, crabs, mussels, and squid do not have scales or fins and are believed to be highly toxic. They naturally absorb all the toxins in the water they live in. Believe it or not, lobster and crabs are crustaceans and are a part of the arthropod family, which include caterpillars, cockroaches, and spiders. Guilt by association is what he's trying to do there. And you also be very careful whenever you read anybody and they make an argument and they say that they are believed to be highly toxic. I could say that, I don't know what, I could say anything that, you know, men that are over 6 feet tall are believed to be irreconcilably wicked. Well, I'm sure that there's somebody out there that believes that, so I could make that statement and it's technically true because somebody believes it. But that doesn't make it true, right? So I'm always careful whenever I read anything about it's believed to be, because that just means, you know, it could be that the guy that's writing it believes it. And he could say, they are believed to be, yeah, by me, right? So who knows? But maybe he's right. Maybe they do absorb toxins. I know they get a lot of mercury. A lot of big fish have a lot of mercury in them. But I don't, that might be a modern phenomenon too. I don't know. And then here's an article from healthline.com, What is Shellfish? Everything You Need to Know. It says, eating contaminated shellfish can lead to foodborne illness. In fact, mollusks such as clams, scallops, oysters, and mussels accounted for over 45% of the seafood-related causes of foodborne illness in the U.S. from 1973 to 2006. Food poisoning from shellfish can result from bacteria, viruses, or parasites that are acquired from their environments. Pathogens flourish in raw shellfish and shellfish that are chilled incorrectly. Therefore, properly storing and cooking shellfish can be an effective way to prevent foodborne illness. Pregnant and breastfeeding women, older adults, and people with compromised immune systems should avoid raw or improperly prepared shellfish. So there is something, and this is more of a scientific type article, there is definitely, could be, risk involved in eating shellfish, especially today when so many people have allergies, because some people, you eat shrimp or crab or something and your throat closes up and you're in big trouble. So there are sicknesses that can come from it. So this could have been one of the reasons that God limited the eating of sea creatures to fish with fins and scales under the law of Moses. Although it is also claimed that eating shellfish may have many health benefits as well. So, you know, I read articles about that too. So who knows? Maybe it's why God gave that commandment. Maybe it's not. Just something to think about anyway. But thankfully, we're not under the law of Moses, and I can enjoy all the seafood that I want, and I love it. So I'm thankful for that, and I'm not worried about the parasites or pathogens or anything else. I just eat it and enjoy it. Now, there could also be spiritual reasons for this dietary law. And I thought John Gill did a good job when he was commenting on Leviticus 11 and verse 2. He listed numerous reasons why God might have given the Jews the dietary law. Let me just grab a drink before I read this lengthy quote. John Gill is pretty good at giving reasons why something might mean this or that. Because when you read his commentary, he usually gives about four different interpretations, or it could be this, it could be that. This rabbi said this, and this guy said this, and then you're left afterward thinking, okay, I don't know any more than whenever I started reading your commentary, because now I just know four opinions. But anyway, he does have some good things to offer. As I read this, after I get done reading it, I'm going to ask you if you noticed anything interesting. So pay attention and we'll see if you get it. Here's what he says. He says, the sons of Noah had free liberty without any restraint or limitation of using for food any living creature that moved upon the face of the earth, in the choice of which they were left to exercise their reason and judgment, and as is the case with us now. But as men have not so nice a smell as some animals have, and cannot distinguish by their senses so well as they what food is most wholesome, which makes the exercise of their reason and judgment necessary. And the people of the Jews, being a special people, and for whom the Lord had a peculiar regard, for the sake of their health, and to preserve them from disease, they were subject to such as... such as the leprosy and others, and to direct them to what was most salubrious and healthful, gave them the following laws, in which, though they are not obligatory upon us, yet may be a direction to us in the use of what may be most suitable and proper food for us, the difference of climates and of the constitutions of men's bodies being considered. Not that we are to suppose that the case of health was the only reason for delivering out these laws to the children of Israel, for other ends, besides that, may be thought to be had in view, as to assert his sovereign right to the creatures. So God is in total control, and he can just say, eat these ones and don't eat these ones. Could have just been that simple. And his disposal of them to them according to his will and pleasure. To lay a restraint on their appetites, that could have been a reason, right? He was just teaching them self-control, to prevent luxury and to teach them self-denial and compliance with his will, just teaching them just to do what I said. It could have been just that simple. As also to keep them the more from the company and conversation of the Gentiles, by whom they otherwise might be led into idolatry. So the Gentiles ate a bunch of different foods, and that kept them from the Gentiles. And to give them an aversion to their idols, to whom the creatures forbidden them to eat. Many of them were either now or would be sacred to them, like cows are to the Hindus or something, although the Jews were allowed to eat cows. And chiefly to excite to a care for purity, both inward and outward, and create in the man abhorrence of those vices which may be signified by the ill qualities of several of the creatures. Like making you disgusted by some disgusting creatures, essentially. And to instruct them in the difference between holy and unholy persons, with whom they should or should not have communion. See Acts 10 and verse 11. So he gives there some reasons, some possible reasons, why God might have given those laws to the Jews. And it could just be like he said, that he's sovereign and he can just say, don't eat that animal, just because I said so, right? Or it could be that he wants to teach them to obey his will or to be able to separate clean from unclean, to make distinctions, any number of things. It could have been. But now, what did you know? Did anybody notice anything? Any of you men, did you notice anything interesting about that passage? Anything jump out at you? Well, that's not the one. This is much more simple than that, actually. It's that I just read for 5 minutes and there was only one period. That was an entire sentence. That whole paragraph that I read, which is like the length of a short book, was one sentence with like 14,000 commas, semicolons, and colons in one period. That's what John Gill does. His whole commentary, it is several volumes, but the nice thing is it's only 6 sentences. So if you can just get through them. You know. Yeah, that guy is something else. Now, the law of Moses, we're just going to wrap it up at this point here. The law of Moses was like a schoolmaster for a child. The Old Testament church was like this child that was in need of a bunch of rules and regulations and, you know, just needed to tell them what to do all the time. Galatians 3 and verse 19. Galatians 3 and verse 19. This could be another reason why the Lord did what he did there in the Old Testament. Galatians 3 and verse 19. It says, wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. So the law was given until the seed should come, until Christ came. So this was a temporary measure given to the children of Israel, and it was only for that period of time. And then in verse 24, it says, wherefore the law, was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ, till the seed should come, remember, to bring us unto Christ, that we might be justified by faith. So it's as if they were children, and the law was their schoolmaster. It's, you know, you send little kids to school so they can learn what they need to learn until they come to maturity, until Christ came, right? And then let's look at Galatians 4, 1 through 5. Now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, differeth nothing from a servant, though he be Lord of all, but is under tutors and governors until the time appointed of the Father. Even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. See, Paul likens us, mankind, or the Jews in this case, as like little children. They were under tutors and governors. They were under that strict law when they were children. But when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. So when you think about it, children, when they're young, they need a lot of rules, right? The younger they are, the more rules they need. You don't give your children free rein when they're young, right? Because foolishness is bound in their hearts and they would do stupid things. They're virtually never going to do the right thing. They need directed constantly. The younger they are, the more direction. When they start to get older, then you give them more and more liberty because they are able to think and to reason and to remember what they've been taught and to they've learned, right? As they continue to grow in maturity and learn to control their passions and desires, they need less rules. And I think parents make a big mistake, and I have known of a few that have done this, that when their children get old, like adult-aged, they're still under all these rules and curfews and all this stuff. And their kids are, I mean, they're old enough to be out of the house, and they're treating them like children. Very foolish, very, very foolish thing to do, especially with boys. As Christians, hopefully mature ones, under the New Testament, we don't need all the rules and regulations, such as the dietary laws under the law of Moses. So when Israel, before Christ came, Israel was under this law like their kids. And they, you know, don't eat that, don't eat that, don't eat that, stay away from that. But whenever Christ comes and we have the New Testament now and we are mature Christians, we don't need all these laws saying don't eat that, 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 and you can eat only this. The Lord says you can eat whatever you want, but remember all things are lawful, but all things are not expedient. Use your judgment. It might not be wise to eat every single living creature that you find. Use some discretion. And that's, I think, the explanation for all, or one of the explanations for all of those thou shalt and shalt nots there in the dietary law of the law of Moses. So that takes us to the end of this sermon. And next time we're going to look at the fact that there is no dietary law under the New Testament. And this should be obvious to all of us that have read the New Testament, but it is not very obvious to many people out there. There are a lot of people out there, and I meet them, quote unquote, online every day in their comments, that they are just dying to be back under the law of Moses, under the yoke of bondage, under the dietary law and the feasts and all the rest of it. It's really something. Anyway, we will pick it up next week with that.